Saluton. I'm afraid that I don't speak any Esperanto or any French, but you are welcome to tell me if you rather listen to me in my mother tongues, Finnish and Swedish, or in Danish or in Norwegian, but I'm going to speak in English. I have a three-page abstract which is on the internet, and I will not read the abstract. I'll start directly. And I will read most of this so that you can both see and hear the same thing. Firstly, as you could see from my first slide about the last speaker of EJAC, languages are today being killed faster than ever before in human history. The most optimistic, realistic linguists estimate that half of today's spoken languages may have disappeared, or at least not be learned by children, around the year 2100. The pessimistic but realistic researchers estimate that we may only have some 10% of today's spoken languages left as vital, non-threatened languages around 2100, or even 5%. Or even 40 to 50 languages, meaning the fully digitalized ones. This is an estimate by the Estonian linguist Mart Rannut. The most important pedagogical reason for both languages disappearing and for so-called illiteracy is the wrong medium of teaching. Indigenous and minority children and children from dominated groups in other contexts, like in Africa, are taught in dominant languages subtractively. They have few linguistic human rights. What is subtractive teaching? Subtractive teaching through the medium of a dominant language often replaces indigenous or minority children's mother tongues. It subtracts from their linguistic repertoire. Additive teaching, which is what we should have, through the medium of the mother tongues, with good teaching of the dominant language as a second language, given by bilingual teachers, adds to these children's linguistic repertoire and makes them high-level bilingual or multilingual. They can learn their own language and other languages well. Now, why do languages disappear? There are two paradigms, two ways of explaining this. Two explanatory paradigms. One is the language death paradigm, and the other one is the language murder paradigm. Languages have been called the vast libraries of human intangible heritage. When these libraries disappear, is it natural death or is it murder? If we think it's death, we think that languages just disappear naturally. They are born, they flower, blossom, and then they disappear, just like things in nature. Languages commit suicide. Speakers are leaving them voluntarily for instrumental reasons, better jobs and so on, and for their own good. If we think that these libraries are murdered, if we say it is arson, these libraries are set on fire, then we say that educational systems, mass media, etc., participate in committing linguistic and cultural genocide, according to the United Nations Genocide Convention's definitions in Articles 2B and 2E. And my way of looking at this is languages do not just disappear naturally, like flowers. Languages do not commit suicide. In most cases, speakers do not leave them voluntarily for instrumental reasons and their own good. Languages are being murdered. Most disappearing languages are victims of linguistic genocide. And educational systems and mass media are important direct agents in this linguistic and cultural genocide. And behind them are, of course, the world's social, economic, techno-military, and political systems. Does it make any difference whether we see it as death or murder? If languages just disappear naturally, there is no agent. The only ones to blame are the speakers themselves. It is their individual and collective responsibility and they have profited by language shift. If languages, on the other hand, have been murdered or killed, we can analyze the structural and ideological agents responsible for this, and they are the world's economic, techno-military, social and political systems. And even when language shift has happened with speakers' so-called consent, the speakers have said, I want to shift, we can analyze the ideological factors behind this consent. And when big languages are learned subtractively, at the cost of the mother tongues rather than additively, in addition to mother tongues, they can become killer languages. And it is killer languages that pose serious threats towards the linguistic diversity of the world. Now, what is a killer language? Being a killer language is not a characteristic of any language. It is a question of how a language functions in relation to other languages. Any language can become a killer language in relation to some other language. And besides, languages do not kill each other. It is the power relations between the speakers of the languages that are the decisive factors behind the unequal relations between the languages, which then cause people from dominated groups to learn other languages subtractively at the cost of their own. And English, the language I am speaking now, is today the world's most important killer language. But most dominant languages function as killer languages vis-a-vis smaller or less powerful languages. So Russian or Hindi or Spanish or French can be killer languages just as well. There is a nested hierarchy of languages. For instance, English can kill Finnish, Finnish can kill the indigenous Sami languages, Finnish can kill sign languages, and so on. There's language cannibalism. All spoken languages can, through enforced oralism, meaning only speaking to deaf people and only teaching them lip reading, all spoken languages can function as killer languages in relation to sign languages. And official or national spoken languages may be especially important killer languages vis-a-vis sign languages. And of course, the American Sign Language may pose serious threats towards all other sign languages if it is learned subtractively. It may be the worst killer language among sign languages. One reason why linguistic human rights in education and maintenance of all the world's languages are necessary is thus to try to counteract linguistic genocide and crimes against humanity, also in education. Now, when I use the word genocide, many people say the term is too strong. You can't use it like that. When we look at the United Nations International Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, which has five definitions of genocide, and where two are about direct physical killing, two of the five definitions are relevant for us. Article 2E, genocide is forcibly transferring children of the group to another group, and Article 2B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. And I'll give you just three small examples. Pirjo Jarnulf's longitudinal study, she looked at Finnish immigrant minority members in Sweden who had had Swedish medium education. They were Finnish speakers, but they had only Swedish medium education. And when these children got their own children as adults, not one of them spoke any Finnish to their own children. Even if they themselves might not have forgotten their Finnish completely, their children were certainly forcibly transferred to the majority group, the Swedish group, at least linguistically. Assimilationist education like this is genocidal. An African example from Zambia and Malawi, Ed Williams' study, some 1,500 students, grades 1 to 7. The Zambian pupils had all education in English. And Ed Williams said, Large numbers of them have very weak or zero reading competence in two languages. They couldn't read in any language. The Malawi children were taught in local languages, mostly their mother tongues, during the first 4 years with English as a subject, and then they were transferred to English medium. They had slightly better test results, even in the English language, than the Zambian students. And in addition, they could read and write their own languages. And its conclusion is, there is a clear risk that the policy of using English as a vehicular language, meaning as the medium of teaching, may contribute to stunting rather than promoting academic and cognitive intellectual growth in these children. And this fits the UN genocide definition of causing mental harm to the children. There's a Canadian report, and there are masses of them, which tells about Canadian Inuit students who were taught in English, and they are neither fluent nor literate in either language. And the report presents statistics showing that the students, who are, of course, of normal intelligence, they end up at only grade 4 level of achievement after 9 years of schooling because of the wrong medium of teaching. That is also causing mental harm to the children. One of my books, which is 818 pages, tells a lot of examples about all of this. Most indigenous and minority education in the world participates in committing linguistic and cultural genocide according to the genocide definitions in the UN Genocide Convention. And we have shown that, for instance, in this report, which is an expert paper written for the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues called Indigenous Children's Education and Indigenous Languages. That expert paper contains sociological and legal argumentation where we show that to educate indigenous and minority children through a dominant language in a submersion or even early exit transitional program violates the human right to education. And this right is in many international human rights documents, also in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. And this convention has been ratified by all other UN member states except two, Somalia and the United States. So there's a copy of this book. It was just republished in India in February with a different cover. You could just have a look at it if you want. It could go around here. Subtractive dominant language medium education for these children prevents access to education because of the linguistic, pedagogical, and psychological barriers that it creates, and thus it violates the right to education. It also often curtails the development of the children's capabilities, and thus it perpetuates poverty. And we build this on the economics Nobel laureate Amartya Sen's theories about children's capabilities. This education is organized against solid research evidence about how best to reach high levels of bilingualism or multilingualism and how to enable indigenous or minority children to achieve academically in school. Our new expert paper called Forms of Education of Indigenous Children as Crimes Against Humanity, which is just now being discussed at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues at their session in New York. In this paper, we again considered the possibility that such subtractive educational policies, implemented in the full knowledge of their devastating effects on those who suffer them, constitute international crimes, including genocide. That states persist in such policies, given that they know the results, can, we conclude, from an educational and sociological point of view, be described as a form of linguistic and cultural genocide. Because dominant language medium education for the children can cause and often causes serious physical and mental harm. So this education can have harmful consequences socially, psychologically, economically, and politically. It can have very serious mental harm, social dislocation, psychological harm, cognitive harm, linguistic and educational harm, and partially through this also economic, social and political marginalization. And it can also often cause serious physical harm, for instance in residential schools, in boarding schools for indigenous children, and as a long-term result of marginalization, for instance alcoholism, suicides, violence and so on. Our 2008 paper contains legal argumentation which shows that forcibly, meaning when alternatives do not exist, mother tongue medium education does not exist, forcibly educating indigenous or minority children in a dominant language, in submersion and even early exit transitional programs, is at least sociologically and educationally genocide. We need some more court cases to ascertain the precise interpretations of some concepts, for instance, mental, in the convention's definitions. But in any case, this education can already now be legally labeled a crime against humanity. And here's something from our conclusions. The various forms of subtractive education to which indigenous children have been and continue to be subject results in very serious and often permanent harmful mental and physical consequences. It is now at odds with and in clear violation of a range of human rights standards and in our view amount to ongoing violations of fundamental rights. It is at odds with contemporary standards of minority protection. And in our, in our view, the concept of crime against humanity is less restrictive in interpretation than genocide and can also be applied to these forms of education. The destructive consequences of subtractive education, not only for indigenous languages and cultures, but also in terms of the lives of indigenous peoples, are now clear, and this applies to minorities as well. The concept of crimes against humanity provides a good basis for an evolution that will ultimately lead to the stigmatization through law of subtractive educational practices and policies. So, linguistic human rights in education are then one necessary but not sufficient prerequisite in the struggle to prevent linguistic genocide and crimes against humanity. When all children attend school, linguistic human rights in education are necessary for any group to reproduce itself as a group. Linguistic human rights are necessary for maintaining linguistic and cultural diversity on Earth and as a mediating factor also for maintaining biodiversity on Earth. And I'll say a few more words about that later. The most central linguistic human right in education is the right to mother tongue medium education in non-fee state schools. So linguistic human rights might be one way of preventing linguistic genocide, promoting integration and defending people against forced assimilation, promoting positive state policies towards minority languages, promoting the maintenance of the world's linguistic diversity, promoting conflict prevention, and promoting self-determination, especially, of course, for indigenous peoples. What then are linguistic human rights? Language rights, some language rights, plus human rights make up linguistic human rights. Some language rights are so necessary for a dignified life that they must be seen as inalienable, meaning no state or individual or group is allowed to violate them. And it is these language rights that are linguistic human rights. If we look at linguistic human rights in human rights instruments, documents, language is one of the most important ones of those human characteristics on the basis of which people are not allowed to be discriminated against. Others are gender, so-called race, and religion. Still, what happens is that language often disappears in the educational paragraphs of binding human rights instruments. If we look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the paragraph on education does not refer to language at all. If we look at the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, it mentions language on a par with race, color, sex, religion, etc. in its general article. But when we come to its education article, it explicitly refers to racial, ethnic or religious groups, but it does not have any reference to language or linguistic groups. So again, language disappears in the education article. It says education shall enable all persons and so on. And you can see there are no linguistic groups in that. Binding educational clauses of human rights instruments, if they mention language, they have more opt-outs and modifications and alternatives and clawbacks and so on than any other articles. If we look, for instance, at the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Persons Belonging to National or Ethnic, Religious and Linguistic Minorities, I have added the emphasis, and the blue ones are, which are positive, they are in blue italics. And opt-outs, meaning those clawbacks or modifications, they are in red bold. The first part, which has something to do with identity, that has only positive things. States shall protect, states shall encourage promotion and so on. Identity is so wishy-washy, such an imprecise concept that you can say anything positive about it. States have to do all sorts of things for identity. There's only one red in what this declaration says about identity. The states shall adopt appropriate measures. What are appropriate measures? But then when we come to language in education, it is only read, states should, not shall, take appropriate measures so that wherever possible, a state can say, oh, we tried so hard, but it was not possible. Persons belonging to minorities have adequate opportunities. What is adequate? Having half an hour of teaching the language as a subject per week, to learn their mother tongue, or to have instruction in their mother tongue. And if we look at some of the latest Council of Europe instruments, the Framework Convention for the Protection of National Minorities, and the European Charter for Regional or Minority Languages, which are the best in the world in this area. What do we have there? Substantial numbers. If there is sufficient demand, the parties shall endeavor to ensure as far as possible, and so on. You can see that any rights that are given here are taken back or are conditional. And who decides the conditions? Does the minority decide the conditions? No, it is the state. So we have all these clawbacks or opt-outs and so on. Pupils who so wish in a number considered sufficient and so on. And that means that the opt-outs and alternatives in both the Charter and the Framework Convention permit a reluctant state to meet the requirements in a minimalist way, which it can legitimate by claiming that a provision was not possible or appropriate, or that numbers were not sufficient or did not justify a provision, or that it allowed the minority to organize teaching of their language as a subject at their own cost. So education, linguistic, human rights, especially the right to mother tongue medium education, do not really exist properly. Still, they are among the most important rights for any minority or any indigenous people. Without them, a minority whose children attend school usually has to accept subtractive teaching through the medium of a dominant majority language. It cannot reproduce itself as a minority, it cannot integrate, but is forced to assimilate. Assimilation is subtractive, integration would be additive. Assimilation is thus enforced subtractive learning of another dominant culture by a dominated group. Assimilation means being forcibly transferred to another group. Integration, on the other hand, is characterized by voluntary, mutual, additive learning of other cultures and languages. Integration means a choice of inclusive group memberships. Human rights lawyer Katarina Tomaszewski, who was earlier, before her untimely death, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Education, said, "The purpose of international human rights law is to act as correctives to the so-called free market and to overrule the law of supply and demand and remove price tags from people and from necessities for their survival." And linguistic and cultural rights in education are, as human rights, necessities for survival. Price tags should be removed from them. Fernand de Varenne from Canada says, "Until recently, most legal observers were probably of the view that there existed no right to be educated in one's own language in international law." And that was what I was showing to you, no right to be educated in one's own language. Now, if we look at the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, its Article 27 still grants the best binding protection for linguistic rights. And it says, in those states in which ethnic, religious, or linguistic minorities exist, persons belonging to such minorities shall not be denied the right, in community with other members of their group, to enjoy their own culture, to profess and practice their own religion, or to use their own language. And the customary reading interpreted this article as firstly excluding groups, even if they are citizens, which are not recognized as minorities by the state. The state can say, "We have no minorities," like Turkey says. Excluding immigrants who have not been seen as minorities, only conferring some protection from discrimination, so-called negative rights, but not a positive right to maintain or even use one's own language, and not imposing any obligations on states. United Nations Human Rights Committee had wrote a general comment on this article in 1994 and interpreted it very differently. They stated that the existence of a minority does not depend on a decision by the state, but requires to be established by objective criteria. So the Kurds are to be seen as a minority in Turkey, even if Turkey does not accept that. It also says that it protects all individuals on the state's territory or under its jurisdiction, meaning also immigrants and refugees, irrespective of whether they belong to the minorities specified in the article or not. It recognizes the existence of a right, a positive right, and it imposes positive obligations on states. What does this imply for national immigrant and refugee minorities? And of course, indigenous peoples should have all the rights that minorities have, plus additional rights. States have to see all national immigrant and all national immigrant and refugee minorities who fulfill objective minority definitions and choose to classify themselves as minorities. States have to see them as minorities protected by Article 27, and this includes sign language users. The minorities must have positive language rights, not only the negative right of protection against discrimination. States have to recognize the existence of a right, and states have positive obligations towards the minorities, including the sign language users. And we have some positive recommendations, declarations, which show how this could be done. But remember, recommendations and declarations are not binding. We have the Hague recommendations regarding the education rights of national minorities, from the OSCE's High Commissioner on National Minorities, And Articles 11 to 13 say that for minorities, mother tongue medium education is recommended at all levels, also in secondary education. And this also includes bilingual teachers in the dominant language as a second language. So if you, for instance, in the United States, if you teach English as a second language, the teacher has to be bilingual and know the children's mother tongue and English. And the explanatory note says submersion type approaches where the curriculum is taught exclusively through the medium of state language and minority children are entirely integrated into classes with children of the majority are not in line with international standards. And then we have the two most recent human rights instruments, United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. I'm not going to say anything about the Disability Convention. It mentions language in many of its articles, but it is not as good as we were hoping that it would be. But I'll just show the two articles which are most important in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples from the point of view that I'm discussing today. Article 13, Indigenous peoples have the right to revitalize, use, develop, and transmit to future generations their histories, languages, oral traditions, philosophies, writing systems, and literatures, and to designate and retain their own names for communities, places, and persons. And states shall take effective measures to ensure that this right is protected. And then there's also something about legal and administrative proceedings, which also say where necessary through the provision of interpretation or by other appropriate means, meaning there are clawbacks also in this one. And then Article 14, Indigenous peoples have the right to establish and control their educational systems and institutions, providing education in their own languages, in a manner appropriate to their cultural methods of teaching and learning. But have the right to establish. That does not mean that it says the state has the obligation to pay for these schools. And that can be interpreted in any old way by the states. Indigenous individuals, particularly children, have the right to all levels and forms of education of the state without discrimination. So they can go to a state school which does not need to have education in their own language, meaning they have access to assimilation education if they want to. And states shall, in conjunction with indigenous peoples, take effective measures in order for indigenous individuals, particularly children, including those living outside their communities, and this is important, to have access, when possible, to an education in their own culture and provided in their own language. But when possible, again, states can say, oh, we tried very hard, but it is not possible to organize it. So even in the latest, and this declaration was worked on for more than 20 years, even in the latest ones, no good. Some progress, but not enough. Now, both indigenous and minority education could, of course, be organized so as to promote high levels of multilingualism. And I just mention a couple of examples. Indigenous education in Nepal and in Orissa, India. The Sami country in Norway and Finland. Minority education in Ethiopia. And deaf education. And that means that there are some promising developments in many parts of the world, including India, Nepal, Peru, Bolivia, Bangladesh, Norway, Finland. I could add to the list several Asian countries. But still in today's situation, there's a lot of nice talk and far too little action. Most countries are really hypocritical. I have the Orissa project here, where in 200 schools, indigenous so-called tribal children from 10 language groups are now being taught through their mother tongues. And there are similar projects on a smaller scale in some other states, for instance, Andhra Pradesh, and plans to start them in several other states. in Nepal. There is a project, multilingual education program for all non-Nepali speaking students at primary schools of Nepal. They are now running 6 pilot projects where indigenous and minority children will be taught mainly in their mother tongues in primary school. And just to comment what Probal said, their materials and curriculum are bottom-up. They are largely planned by the villagers themselves, meaning the language in them is something that is easy to understand, that comes directly from the villages. And the plan is to extend this to all non-Nepali mother tongue children in Nepal, and Nepal has more than 100 languages. In the Sami country, both in Norway and Finland, not in Sweden yet properly, indigenous Sami children have the right to have their first 9 years of education through the medium of Sami, and there are 10 Sami languages, and they have excellent results. And there is a very important report from Ethiopia, which has studied 9 of the 11 districts there, and the report shows very clear patterns of learner achievement at grade 9, 8, 8, 10 and 12. And grade 8 data show that those learners who have had 8 years of mother tongue medium education plus English as a subject perform better across the curriculum in all subjects, including English, than those with only 6 years or only 4 years of mother tongue medium education. So the more mother tongue medium education, the better the children become, both academically, school achievement, and in learning the language of wider communication. There are also a lot of good deaf education programs, but I'm not going to say anything about them. There's also very good teacher training, and I think the one in my country, Finland, is at the moment the best one in the world. And the one who started it was Markku Jokinen, who is the president of the World Federation of the Deaf. In this book, which I have participated in editing, there are articles from all over the world on how multilingual education has been and can be organized, imagining multilingual schools, languages in education, and glocalization, meaning global, local, glocalization. And I just wish that every minister of education would think what this person says. Abdul Aziz Tayyib, whom I interviewed in Iraq, in Iraqi Kurdistan, in March 2006, who was then Minister of Education, he said, every child in the world has the right to education through the medium of their mother tongue. And in Iraqi Kurdistan, they are trying to also act on this, not only say it. So, to finish, when states, including the ones who voted against the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, meaning Australia, Canada, Aotearoa, New Zealand, and the United States, who voted against it, when they refused to grant Indigenous peoples and both national and immigrant minorities an unconditional right to the most decisive linguistic human rights in education, the right to be educated in one's own language, in a non-fee state school, they are seriously harming both the children concerned and themselves and our planet. So lack of linguistic human rights, especially in education, is co-responsible for illiteracy, for lack of school achievement, educational waste, poor life chances, disappearance of groups, nations, peoples through forced assimilation, and killing of the world's languages and linguistic diversity and traditional ecological knowledge as prerequisites for the maintenance of biodiversity. So subtractive dominant language medium education may lead to the extinction of indigenous languages and thus contributing to the disappearance of the world's linguistic diversity. And a partial result of this can be the disappearance of the knowledge about biodiversity and its maintenance, and through this, diminishing prerequisites for human life on Earth. And only this one slide about that. Meaning, we know now that linguistic diversity and biodiversity are both correlationally and causally related. If I had 1 hour more, I would love to talk about this. Knowledge about how to maintain biodiversity is encoded in small languages, mainly indigenous languages. And through killing them the way we do today, we are killing the prerequisites for maintaining biodiversity on Earth. Most of the world's mega biodiversity is in areas under the management or guardianship of indigenous peoples. Most of the world's linguistic diversity resides in the small languages of indigenous peoples. Much of the detailed knowledge of how to maintain biodiversity is encoded in the languages of indigenous peoples. And if we continue as now, most of the world's indigenous languages will be gone by 2100. Not many of them have a chance. A few big ones, Quechua, North Sami, maybe a few others, not many. And then Colin Baker, in a review of my big book, which went round here, in the language of ecology, the strongest ecosystems are those that are the most diverse. That is, diversity is directly related to stability. Variety is important for long-term survival. Also political stability, of course. Our success on this planet has been due to an ability to adapt to different kinds of environment over thousands of years, atmospheric, like ice age, as well as cultural. And such ability is born out of diversity. Thus, language and cultural diversity maximizes chances of human success and adaptability. Biocultural diversity, meaning biodiversity plus linguistic diversity plus cultural diversity, is essential for long-term planetary survival because it enhances creativity and adaptability and thus stability. And today we are killing biocultural diversity faster than ever before. And I have two quotes to finish. Vandana Shiva, ecological multiples are insurance. In any crisis, uniformity is the worst way to respond. Diversity is resilience. And Diana Ackerman, who questions our rationality, we are among the rarest of the rare, meaning we people, not because of our numbers, but because of the unlikeliness of our being here at all, the pace of our evolution, our powerful grip on the whole planet, and the precariousness of our future. We are evolutionary whiz kids who are better able to transform the world than to understand it. Other animals cannot evolve fast enough to cope with us. It is possible that we may also become extinct, and if we do, we will not be the only species that sabotaged itself, merely the only one that could have prevented it. And Esperantists are some of the people who are most active in the world in trying to prevent this. So thank you to all Esperantists. Dankon.